Oh, hello, love. What's that? You looking for dropped plates, late food and a belligerent attitude? Next door down, my love. No, no, this is the Failing Writers podcast. It's all right. It's an easy mistake to make. Easy mistake.
So I don't know about you boys, has anyone else got a light? You know, sometimes when you wake up in the middle of the night and realise that you called your teacher mum once and it's still really embarrassing, or someone brought you food at the restaurant and said, have a nice meal, and you said, you too. I'm like, oh. Does anybody else feel like that about the improv that we did last week? Was it just me?
I've just blanked it. What were we talking about? Sorry?
You just blanked it out.
It's gone.
Okay.
I think we did such a good job of inhabiting characters. Yeah. That it doesn't feel like it was us that did it.
So, okay, I like that. Yeah. That's maybe a way for me to deal with it. Yeah.
That's a good point, actually. Dave and I use quite different voices, whereas you just went with your own voice, really, didn't you, Tom? So
well, I used a few different voices.
Yeah, really.
don't think consistency was...
Consistent, no.
I was wondering whether it just is, not that I've been thinking about it constantly for the past week, whether the audience thing is like a massive thing about it. Without that extra, you've got no one to bounce off or to get a reaction off.
I think that's really true.
And the fact that we couldn't physically see each other. I think that's a big part of it as well, because you can't read when, you know, like you get a cue when someone's about to say something, or you little visual cues.
They just throw the eyes and give you a little bit of
Don't go down that way.
I think that's very true. Also, when the audience laughs, it gives you like a moment to think of the next line.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's assuming that the audience would have laughed.
Well, I'm not sure we would have got many more.
We would have got a lot of time
if it
obviously.
Was live, but maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
We could have thought of something whilst somebody was saying, "Get off! You suck!"
Maybe we don't need to bring that up. Maybe I shouldn't. Yeah, we should.
Let's move on.
Okay.
That's the great thing about improv, isn't it? It's done and then. You never have to think about it again.
Unless you've recorded it for forever.
Put it on the internet forever.
Yeah. Well, I just don't listen to it.
Moving on then. What have you been writing this week, boys?
Would you like to go first, Dave? I'll invite you first.
I'll let somebody else take that question whilst I think about it.
I have been writing. I've been doing more editing. Having never done editing before, I don't really know what I'm doing, but all I'm doing is going back to the beginning and then... sort of doing like pathetic tweaking.
Right.
Because I know that at some point I'll have to make some sort of fairly major structural edits that I don't really want to have to do. But that's what I'm doing at the moment.
Did you give yourself a bit of time between finishing and editing?
No, because I sort of know the things that I need to kind of tidy it up and make it a bit better. But you're absolutely right. The next thing I'm going to do, once I've done that and made it make sense, because a lot of the, like half the book, I just wrote forward.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that I have to go back and change. I thought I'll do that because I know I'm kind of in it and I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then after that, I'm gonna give it a little break and then reread it at some point. But not quite there yet.
Because the danger is, isn't it, that if you don't get your editing right, you're going in and you're doing little tweaks and bits and changing, and I'll just move that paragraph around, and you're wasting time editing stuff that you're later going to completely delete.
Yeah, it's true. I just want it in an order, and I want it to make sense so that if I do come back to read it, I don't just dismiss it, if you know what I mean.
I like the way you're saying that quite passively, as if you're not involved in the process there. You just kind of want it to sort itself out.
That's probably how I see it, yeah. Yeah, what about you, Dave? Come on, have you thought of anything?
No, I've not thought of a good reason why I haven't done it. So I had, the last time... I answered this question very positively.
Dave, you can't just go back and tell us what you said last time. That doesn't count.
Can I not? Is that... Oh. Anyway, I was very much inspired by that. And then time has just gone past and stuff happened and things and reasons and excuses. And no, I haven't done anything.
So you haven't been back to your little place with your little fella? And
no. There've been bank holidays, Easter... things, stuff. I don't know.
Yeah.
No, okay. I haven't done anything. Don't make me feel bad.
I think we'll let you off. I think we'd be kind.
I think we can say it's okay, but we don't want this answer next time, Dave.
No, okay? I won't. This won't happen again. I feel
it will happen again.
Of course it'll happen again.
Hopefully not next time we speak.
Not next week. Yeah. No.
Okay.
No.
Thomas.
Nothing of major note, but just editing.
How are you finding that?
I don't really know what I'm doing to some extent.
Yeah, same.
There's no major issues that I can see. with the structure as it is. I have a feeling I might want to change the ending, possibly, but not in any seismic sort of way. Mm. So my current edit, so I've done kind of a first edit, and there were some things that needed swapping round about which character was doing what and where, and you know, there's little threads of...
Yeah, things that just work better when you look at it again, yeah.
So now I've got my next edit, which I've just kind of called going through and trying to make it funnier. Just kind of like sharpening up stuff or squeezing an extra joke in a style and humour edit.
Nice.
If there is such a thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is.
Yeah. There is
good.
Now.
Yeah, no, I know what I'm doing. So that's, not a lot of it, to be honest. Like, Dave, time has kind of flown past in that awkward way it does. It's not that I've not been meaning to. So that's, I've not just ignored it. I have been just trying to make use of the odd half hour in there.
That's good.
I was thinking this is exactly the situation in the last sort of week or so, is where I should have been maybe going off and, you know, I was saying about entering some contests as part of my targets for this year.
Yes.
That would have been a good thing to do, just to focus on a short piece and get it sent somewhere.
Dip in and out
so
stuff.
I was kind of doing something that was nicely ring-fenced off and was very doable, but... So I might use that in the future.
I'm trying to get better at that, the little pockets of time thing.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I don't know why it's so difficult that you feel that you need to have this perfect storm and the right snacks and the right drink and the right lighting and the right room sense.
Yeah, just to get your head in the game, really, isn't it?
Because it's really incredibly easy. If you were to line up actually getting on and writing something with any of the other excuses or any of the other things that you could do, they're all so much easier, aren't they? Just staying in that chair. I've got a reclining sofa now. So once I've got the feet up on that, it takes actual time to lower it and stand up and walk across to the computer. So that's a good reason for not doing anything.
Yeah. It does beg the question, do we even like writing?
Well, do you know what? I was thinking this the other day. Because I've always thought, writing, that's my main thing. That's what I've always wanted to do. And then I thought, well, why haven't I done more of it then? Like, if it is what I really want to do, why don't I just do it?
The evidence is saying otherwise, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking about people that do actually just get things done and become massively successful on the back of doing that.
Yes, we should probably talk about people like that. Because that would be more interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we're having a chat with Robert Popper. Or we did have it. Myself and John had a chat with Robert Popper a little while ago now.
Remind us, Tom, who is he? What does he do? What does he do?
He's probably best known for writing Friday Night Dinner, the Channel 4 comedy. But as we find out talking to him, he got involved in an awful lot of different stuff.
He's also the man behind the brilliant Time Waster letters, if anyone's come across them. And my favourite, BBC's Look Around You.
Of course, yeah.
Wow, which is bloody brilliant.
Yeah. Now, if I remember rightly, the first thing we asked Robert Popper was the question.
Oh, we did.
So I think that's where it starts, yeah.
Excellent.
And do you know what, Dave? He didn't just go, oh, no, I've not been done anything for 2 weeks.
Well, more fool him.
Probably a lesson there for us, isn't there? Robert Popper, what have you been writing this week?
What have I been writing? What haven't I been writing? Because I haven't been writing.
Welcome to the podcast. That's,
No, I have a bit. I have actually, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of trying to write a sort of, well, yeah, two things. A kind of a script, which I'm not sure what it is yet or where it's going. So I've been writing scenes, which is, I think is the thing I normally do is just write ideas and then go, oh, actually, I'll write them as scenes. So I've got lots of scenes, none of which fit together, in any way. And I don't even know if the names match, but I forget the names. So I've been doing that, which has been going okay. Scenes. And then, it's quite a good word, actually, scenes. And then I am sort of writing, very vague, it's very vague, this. I'm writing, trying to write a book, but it's a weird, it's a weird book. And I annoyingly can't really say what it is, not because I'm being a dick, but because it's sort of like a secret sort of book. I'm not rewriting Mein Kampf or something like that. It's like a sequel. It's just, yeah. So I'm trying to write a book. I'm halfway through it. And whether it'll, it'll become a book, who knows? So I'm doing, those are the two things I'm doing. Two things. And I am writing a musical.
What?
No, I'm not. I'm not writing.
Oh, that was the interesting bit. We're going to ask.
It was.
So with the script, do you have? Are you going into that then with like an overarching idea of what it might be, or you're literally writing little sketches and scenes?
Just stuff that makes you laugh.
That your hope kind of gels together.
Good question. Well, I've got a sort of idea. I've had a few ideas recently, and I'm jumping from one to one, each one, you know, swap. I can't speak English. I'm jumping from one to each one, as they say. That's a good writer. That's going in
that,
my
That script. Old cliche phrase. Yep.
Yeah, I'm going to put that in. Actually, it's too cliche. So I had a few ideas the last few months, and I've been writing a bit on one, then going, oh, I'm not sure about this one, and swapping. I'm not normally this kind of like jumpy around. Normally I go, this is the idea and I'm doing it, but I haven't, because I'm not like that at the moment. I've got a few little ideas, and this one is the one that's pinging the most. And so I've got a kind of overarching idea, but I haven't worked it all out. Weirdly, like I don't know if that's bad, but say when I did Friday Night Dinner, I didn't really ever know what the episodes would be about before I started them. So I never sat down and worked, right, the series is going to be about this. And all these are all my stories right now. I'm going to write them. So I don't know if that's mad, but that's how I've generally been writing. So I'm writing scenes, and there's some good scenes. Oh, that's good. And then, oh, that's a bit rubbish. You know what it's like. And then, actually, I can turn it into that, or can put it into that scene. But I haven't got a script yet.
Are they scenes that are kind of based on characters or on situation or on both? I mean, obviously both will matter.
Both will do.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. No, they're both. Yeah, so it's characters mixing together and then things happen. Normally I like quite...
This is quite vague, isn't it?
Sounds brilliant. I can't wait to see it on TV.
It sounds
absolutely electric.
But my question to you is, has it been done before?
Well, I mean, it sounds quite original to me.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I keep going with it.
Yeah, definitely.
It's set in a world where mint is forbidden. That's all I can say.
It sounds like one of Tom's ideas, actually, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't nicked your idea.
Can we come... Let's come back to Friday Night Dinner. That was obviously quite a big hit show. 6 series over 9 years. That's a lot of coming up with ideas constantly. So presumably, did you write every episode? Presumably you're like drafting people in to help come up with ideas or not.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, no, I wrote them all myself. It's funny that, because you know, when you work in TV, most people just don't know how any TV show works or anything. But I had a great comment. It's from someone's boyfriend who said to me, so you wrote Friday Night Dinner? Yeah, right. So that means that you came up with the idea and then you hand it to the team of script writers and then they write it all. They write all the words. No.
That would be the best job ever, wouldn't it?
That would
That's
be.
Amazing.
Having the general idea.
Yeah, he said, well, no.
There you go, chaps, right away.
Yeah, that would be lovely. He said, no, you just have like the general idea and tell them the general, and then they go and do the work.
I love that. This is just brilliant. I've an idea about this hotel owner in Torquay, and I'd like it to be quite funny. There you go.
Done. Yeah, so I was, so you actually sit down and you write all the words. You know, I just write the numbers. So that was me writing it. Yeah, I had two really great executive producers, Kenton Allen, who's brilliant, and Caroline Leddy. And Caroline Leddy is kind of my sort of day-to-day person I'll go to. So Caroline, if you don't know, she's like an unsung massive hero of comedy. So she produced Brass Eye. She used to run Channel 4 Comedy. She's brilliant. She... I oversaw creatively, though. So she's an exec, but she creatively properly runs it. So she did, like, Smack the Pony. She did Derry Girls. She did In Between Us. She did My Show. She did Green Wing. She's, like, the best. So I've got her to talk to and run my ideas by. And also what I have is when I get to the end of my script and I'm ready, I show her it, and she gives me, like, 60 notes, which my friend Damon, who writes the In Between Us, he works with her, which he calls the instructions, because you just do them, they're all good. And you do every note. I mean, there's no point arguing, they're all brilliant. And then you get 20 notes after that, you know, and then you get 7 notes and then 3 and it's done. So other than that, it's me in a room going mad and saying, oh, I can't do this. And then it's done. Oh, it's done. Right, the next one. what's that going to be about? I don't know.
Wow, starting from scratch again. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'd sometimes have like, I'd have like my board on, in my room with like ideas. I'd have my like my list of all my funny thoughts or ideas and a massive list, you know, on my computer. And I'd have some and lots of scenes I've written over the years. Mm. And I'd always look at those. And sometimes I go, oh, I know this one is going to be about, I don't know, mum having a surprise party, but she's planned it herself secretly or whatever. Oh, no, that's going to be a good episode. But sometimes I sit down and go, I don't know what this episode is about at all. And I don't plot it all out ever. I haven't, on Friday Night Dinners, it was mad. I normally knew the beginning and knew sort of, oh, the end, that'll be good if that happens at the end. But I never knew the middle ever. So I would just start writing and then see. And sometimes that was really bad because I was like, oh no, I don't know how to get out of this one.
I've written myself into a
massive corner. Yeah, you probably know when you see those episodes, you'll know those ones, the bad ones.
Yeah, the uncomfortable bit in the middle where everything kind of stops and then it goes off on a tangent somewhere different.
Yeah, into like the mint world or something like
that. Is that not a testament to the strength of the characters in it, though, that that's how you can go at it?
Do you think? I mean, look, it all takes place more or less in one place, in the mint cavern, I'll stop that joke now, but in the house, so, which is restrictive, which is annoying, but also good, because, well, I've got to do it in there, and there aren't many characters, so that helps. You know, it's good and bad, I suppose. But I would know at any given point, probably by series two or three, how anyone's going to react, so that helps. Mm. And I knew that Jim is going to be at the door, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, but still, it definitely got harder to think of, I've done that one, I can do that,
But how much of Friday Night Dinner was informed by your own family experiences?
I don't really know, actually. Earlier on, there was lots of stories that are true. So my dad is basically Martin Goodman, not quite as bad-tempered, but that's basically, he is that man.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and me and my brother aren't those two, but we did, you know, fight the whole time.
Yeah.
And we, to this day, have a joke about ruining each other's food. When my brother came on set once, we were outside during, I mean, when anyone ever comes on set, they think, oh, this is so exciting. But they find out you're spending 45 minutes, you know, filming someone putting a glass down in the right place, and that's it. But you've got to do three angles. And then we were outside, you know, having a cup of tea or something, and I was talking to someone, and I didn't even notice, but my head turned, and between sips, you know, half a minute sips, he had poured so much salt into my tea, which was brilliant. So that still goes on. That still goes on to this day, the ruining of food, which I still enjoy. And also, I know it's fucking childish, but my brother, like, he runs a company and he has a notebook, which is like where he keeps all his notes in for all the meetings and things. But my favourite thing is if I go to his house, I find a notebook and I move it like six pages on and I draw some insane drawing, normally of a man holding a banner that just says, I eat excrement or something.
Yeah.
And he said several times he's in meetings, he turns the page. But now he checks his bag every time, his work bag, I come round. So
I think we might be kindred spirits.
Oh, yeah? I used
to do that to sales executives when I worked in...
Go on, tell me, what sort of things did you do?
One of my favourites was to get their business cards.
Oh, yeah.
And take some out from the middle and rewrite their job titles and then put them back in.
Yeah. What sort of job titles would you write?
Oh, God, I don't know. I think my favourite was I worked with a sales executive who looked a little bit like Homer Simpson, and I did write... Homer Simpson lookalike on that one, which it's less funny because you can't see him.
No, it's still funny.
But if you could see him, you would think that's really clever, actually.
I've always thought of a good title for a job. I'd love to see it advertised as, you know, looking for a company that's, or someone that is looking for a murderer's assistant, which I think would be good. Like a proper advert with just, you know, references required, etc.
And the other thing I did was I once wrote a spoof letter to Walker's Crisps and got a £2.50 voucher back. Now, I did that in, I think it was 2002. When did you start writing that funny book you did about writing letters to people?
Yeah, I did a couple of those Time Waster letter books. Well, I started writing them in like probably 2000, and I wrote them for a few years, and then the first book was about 2004, but I didn't write to...
So you had a head start on me on that one. That'd be why I wrote one
Yeah, but your book was
very successful.
Your
I got
book
a
was great, but it was just the one letter. But it was a great book.
Yeah.
It was called The Crisps Letter.
But, it, you know, it took a decent amount of creative talent and exertion to do that.
Yeah.
How do you do that with so many letters? How long did it take you?
Oh, it took me a long time. Well, I did it. I mean, my favourite thing is writing things just for fun.
Yeah.
So it was, I think it was a friend of mine had said that he'd been sent a garden brochure. Kept getting sent them, and he doesn't have a garden. And he sent me the brochure, and I wrote to them, and I got a reply. I thought, this is funny, and I showed him, and he laughed. I think it was like I designed garden furniture, and I designed these scarecrows made from beef. That was it. And then they wrote back, "Are you sure these are made of beef?" And I said, "So sorry, it should have said beel, B-E-E-L, no such word." And then they wrote back, "Re-beel scarecrows." And I thought, this is great. And then I started writing more. And then where I was working as TV company, they'd given me my own office. I mean, I wasn't like high level or anything. I think they're just moving me away. But it was brilliant because I had a great facility. I used to say to my mate, wonderful facilities. I used to just write the letters there, and I'd press, you know, print and run to the fucking photocopier right outside my boss's thing.
Sometimes before everyone got it.
They sometimes would find photocopies of these mad drawings and go, and like, I'd left them and said, what are these? But they had a library there in the TV company, which is so funny, a library in a TV company. And they had a big book called The Directory of Associations and Hobby Groups of Britain.
Wow.
I mean, I ended up buying it, and it was 600 quid, and it was worth every penny because every page was like the British Marble Playing Association, the British Lizard Society, you know. And I would just open any page, and I would just write. And I would literally normally just write the first thing that would come in my head, and it would be too mad, and then I'd edit it down. But once it became a thing, like people started liking it, I thought, oh, they said you should try and do a book instead of just doing it for no reason.
Instead of just doing it to annoy people for your own amusement.
And then I thought, okay, so I worked out how many pages. I got turned down loads for book deals. It didn't happen for ages. And then finally I got a book deal. And then I remember I think I had enough of the first book and I thought, oh, I had a feeling it might be popular because people seem to like it. And I thought, they might give me a second book, which they did. It'll be really hard to write that once this one's come out. So I need to write them now before it's come out. So I worked out how many months I needed, and I worked out how many letters I probably need to write, which was probably about 600, 1,000, I don't know. Probably.
I was going to ask, what's the hit rate like in terms of responses?
I really can't remember now, but I must have written about, between the books, 1,000, 2,000 letters, probably.
It's a real art as well, because the first letter has to be, I mean, obviously it has to be quirky, but also relatively plausible, doesn't it?
Well, you say that. It's a mixture. Sometimes they do, and then sometimes I just would write the insanest one thing ever. And sometimes they would reply. Like, there's one to the British Egg Association, and it said something like, I hate quoting my own work, but it's not even work. It's just stupidness. It says something like, it was the maddest first sentence I thought of. I think it was really early in the morning. Something like, my spirit guide, Mr. Crisp, a yellow ant, is convinced that Hollywood actor Tom Selleck is the face of the British Egg Association. Is this true? And I thought, I can't send that. And I did, and they wrote back. So, yeah, because I was always told, well, don't make them too mad, the first ones. And I sort of tried to do that, but sometimes I thought, no, I want to send something insane. But yeah, that was so much fun.
Yeah, the character Robin Cooper, did he just kind of appear wholesale? Was someone
I was
going to
write Robert
on.
Popper, and I'm like, oh, I can't write that my real name. So what? And I wrote Robin Cooper. At the time, I didn't even like the name, but it's kind of stuck now. And you know, I'm happy with that. And the voice, I didn't have the silly, squeaky, voice that I do for the stupid phone calls.
Mm.
But then I started doing phone calls, and I just would like doing that voice. I think I did it at school. When the headmaster used to make a joke sometimes, there'd be a ripple of laughter, and I would wait to stop, and I would always go, and he would look round, like the teachers would look round like, who's that? So that was my joke at school I did for years, but they never found me.
They're very good. I enjoyed the telephone calls. Very good. Would you be happy to give us permission to play one of your...
Sure. If you want to play one, Having a Lie Down was my favourite.
Oh, I love that one.
Thank you. Which was when this guy kept phoning me all the time to sell me something for Sky TV or Sky Satellite insurance. And I waited for him ready. And then I did all four characters of the same family and that. I think that's the greatest thing I've done in my life. They can shoot me now.
Are we all right to play that out now?
Now.
Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling from a company called Sat Support.
Sat on the support.
No, it's a company called Sat Support.
Circumference is Sat Support. Oh, company, yes, hello there.
Do you have satellite TV, Sky TV?
I've never been on a satellite.
It's showing on our system. Your manufacturer's warranty has now expired.
Yes, I can understand.
Yeah, but the reason for my call today,
yes,
is to get a new warranty set up for you.
Right.
So that if anything goes wrong, you just call us and you don't have
what
to sort
of
for it.
What sort of things could go wrong? For example, something fell on it, like if I was to drop 40 books on top of it and it smashed, is that covered by the man? Would he be able to pay and take the books back?
Well, if anything went wrong with the box...
Yes.
Or if anything went wrong with the dish on the wall outside...
Oh, the dish, you mean the dish that picks up the pictures from the space?
Yeah.
Right. Maybe it's best if you speak to my brother, who does most of the electrical things in the house.
Right. Is he there?
Yes. Shall I get him for you?
Yes, please.
Hold on one moment. Bow. Yes. Someone about me. Hello there.
Hello there.
How nice to meet you.
I was just talking about the Sky TV system.
Yes, yes, yes.
Unfortunately, the manufacturer's warranty has expired.
Oh dear, oh dear. Does this mean that it's expired, that we'll be somehow in trouble with the police or something like this because we haven't paid or... Oh dear,
no,
oh dear.
No, no, no. When you first get the box,
yes,
they call a manufacturer's warranty.
Yes, 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 yes.
Which means that if anything goes wrong within the first 12 months,
yes,
they come out and fix it for you for free.
Now, that's very good, but we're not in trouble with the police or anything like that.
No, not at all.
Not
sir.
At all.
But
you're not actually phoning from the police, are you?
No, sir, no. Right. I'm calling from a company called SAT Support.
Right, then you support the police, you work with the police.
No, sir, it's nothing to do with the police.
Right, you work against the police.
It's nothing at all to do with the police.
Right.
If you call anybody out to come and fix it for you, they will charge you a lot of money to come out and fix it.
Then they would need to go to the police because they're overcharging us. So what you're saying is we should report them to the police if they overcharge us, yes?
No, it's nothing at all to do with the police.
Right. Maybe you should speak to my sister, who's the one that seems to know what goes on in this household. Can I get her? Her name is Kitty.
Yes, certainly, sir.
Certainly. Hold on 1 second. 1 second, sir. Kitty? Kitty? There's a man on the phone.
I don't understand
him,
so talking about the police.
Okay. Hello, is this
the police? No, it's regarding the Sky TV system.
Hold on a moment. Do we have Sky in the house?
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do have Sky in the house, yes. It's for the television.
Yeah, well, the reason I called...
We have had a problem with the box in that it was starting to buzz, and, we keep cats here, and one of them seemed to have got sort of zapped.
Right.
Would that be something to do with the warranty of asphyxiation?
I'm not exactly sure. Is it still just a standard box that you have?
Actually, the person that can tell you that is my mother will know, because she's the one that actually paid for the thing.
Right. And is she available?
Yes, she is. I will get her. I'm sorry about this. Hold on 1 second. Mother! Mother, there's a man!
Mother. Larry, can you speak to me?
Hello?
Good morning.
Good morning to you. How are you, sir?
Well, the reason I've called this morning...
Yes?
...is I've called regarding the Sky TV system.
The what?
I've called regarding the Sky TV.
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
We watched the programme about the chef. Last time he made poached eggs.
Yeah, were there nice poached eggs?
I didn't eat them. He was on the television.
Right, okay. Well, the reason I've called...
Yes?
...is because the manufacturer's warranty on the Sky has now run out.
Right.
And unfortunately, if anything went wrong...
Yes?
...and you have to call somebody out to come and fix it for you...
Right. You're phoning from the fix-it man.
Well, no, I'm sort of.
My bath is broken. Do you fix things like that? Because the bath is leaking, it smells damp. Nothing to do with the TV, though, is it?
No, unfortunately
you can't
not.
Fix the bath. The smell is quite nasty.
Right.
Yes.
That means
I'm 90 years old.
Oh.
My friend Doreen is 101, but she stole money from a man, and in the end, she got sent to court, but she was let off because of her age. I think she should have gone to prison, no matter what the age or crime.
What, as I was saying, what we can do for you today.
Yes.
Is we can set up a warranty on it for you.
Do you mind if I have a little lie down?
No, you go ahead.
Okay.
Are you still there?
Just having a little lie down.
Okay. If you're going to have a lie down, would it be more convenient for me to call back later on, when you've had your lie down?
I'm having my lie down right now. Be nice.
Would you like me to call back later on, after you've had your lay down?
Very tired.
I'll tell you what, I'll call back later on, after you've had your lay down, when you're not feeling so tired, okay?
So sleepy.
Okay. I'll call back later on for you, alright?
Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night.
Yeah, Tom and I had it. We had a little go, didn't we, at writing a time waster letter?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I wish Anna said that now.
Well, we did it when we first approached you to see if we could get a reply.
I was gonna mention that after we'd finished talking.
What was the letter?
To Mr. Popper.
What was the letter?
Oh, sorry, John. I dropped you in it now. I realised I went much too strong with my first letter. I realised the art of it. Oh. It's a little bit scary and confrontational, mine.
What did you say? That you wanted to like put poison in my eyes or something?
No, it was asking for compensation from a website, basically because they'd encouraged me to buy a particular breed of dog because they'd bigged up this particular breed of dog on this website.
That sounds good.
But I think it just went too silly.
Compensation re dogs. That's good.
Yeah. What about you, Tom? Who did you write to?
I mean, I wrote mine to Walker's Crisps again because I had success with them 20 years ago.
Yeah, and they probably remember you there.
I know it's pathetic, but I just didn't have the confidence. And I.
Did they write back?
They didn't get back to me this time.
Oh. You see, I think that's interesting, isn't it? Because letter writing, it's just not a thing now, is it?
Well, that's what I was going to ask as well. What would happen if you had the idea for that book now and it had never been done and you did it now? I guess emails?
I reckon letters. You'd write letters, but it would be even harder for people to write back.
Yeah.
You know, less people would write back.
And it wouldn't be as formal. It wouldn't be as nice, would it? Do you know what I mean? There's something about the formality of a letter, the way it's all...
I think you get quite a lot of formal... You know, if you get a letter, rarely. It's rarely at the end. Cheers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think people would... I think they'd write back. Yeah. It depends. Yeah. I think they would. It would be hard, but you would get replies.
In an email, are we talking?
No, letters.
Yeah, it has to be a letter. That's what I mean. Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk about Look Around You. Look Around You. That is some beautiful TV, I think.
Thank you.
How much research did you do for that? I feel like you have to have watched loads of those old BBC educational programmes before you started.
Me and Peter Serafinovich, who made it, and Tim Kirkby directed it. So me and Pete... Did we do it? I think, actually, so we became buddies, best buddies, suddenly. We realised we liked the same stupid things and had a real comedy, silly connection. And I can't remember how we got into the thing, but I think I might have said, you remember those old scores programmes? Not the Open University ones, but they were like ones with like this weird blue background. I mean, I didn't even know they were like ITV ones. And do you remember those ones? Yeah, we could make one of those, like real but nonsense. And I was randomly working at Granada Television at the time, production company, where I was writing. I fucking did nothing there. I have to sue me now, but that's where I was writing my letters. And I realised these programmes were made by Granada, and I found out that I could get things from the library. So I would like go on their like library thing on the net or whatever it was there. And I go, oh, they've got this like on VHS, and they'd have like six programs on them, and they'd have some of these science programs, and I'll just get loads of these and copy them, and me and Pete would sit in his house in his flat, and we would not get stoned, and we would watch them, and we just were addicted, you know. We watched lots of them, hours and hours, and we were laughing, and we said we should make one all about make a short film for fun all about calcium. Because we thought, if we're going to make a short film, they're boring generally. Not all, you know, oh, I'm making a short film. Oh, okay. But if you say it's the world's first comedy about calcium, people might go, ah, what do you mean? So we did it not for a TV show. And then we started writing it. And then I think like 6 weeks after starting writing it, we had made it. We met Peter, worked with Tim before. Tim's a brilliant director and he's directed, like, you know, I think he's done Veep and stuff like that now. Everything, he's brilliant.
Oh, you just made it? Like, just...
Yeah, we got a team. We got a little team. We had all the meetings in Granada in my little office. We've got a great art director called Rosie Thomas, who does loads of things now. And we had no money. And we made it. And we filmed it, like, all illegally. Like, I remember once we had a scene where we had to... It was something about, I don't know, intelligent calcium. That's it. Which comes as sort of like golden jelly blob thing, which is dangerous. And it causes a thing called the Helvetica scenario, where you see us, we shot a thing where through like a, looked like a lab window, where it was Peter's brother, but he has no face. And he's like being watched by a scientist noting down as this guy's clawing at the window. This has happened to him. But we found this old, like, it looked like a 1960s petrol station that was still open, but really bare and weird. Like something you might get in the country in the 60s. It's odd. Mm. So that was good. So we went there 6:30 in the morning. We set up this sign that says Danger Helvetica. And it was me and James, actually, in like jumpsuits and like gloves and goggles, walking along with this like plate with this blob of jelly, walking towards like the opening of this, the door or whatever that was locked, as if we're going into this lab. And we filmed that all. And then we put all the equipment away. And as we drove out, the people that run that garage all turned up for work, missed us by 2 seconds. They had no idea that if they turned up, they go, what the fuck are you doing? What is this? So that was funny. So it was all kind of filmed like that. It was brilliant. It was just great fun. It was, yeah, chaos and fun. That was just a short film, by the way. So that wasn't like a TV thing. That was just for fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't film the entire series like that, would you? That would be hard work.
That would be. You'd get arrested too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you strike me as someone who actually does get things done. Like, you have great ideas, but you also have what I think is probably quite a rare ability to follow them through.
Yeah, it's a bit mad.
They're not always compatible skills, though.
No, and they're not always good ideas.
Well, that doesn't matter if you get them done, though, does it? You're halfway there.
As long as you do them.
Yeah.
It's quantity over quality, I would say. No, that was fun because we just made that, and then it took ages to edit because we had to use free time and in edit places.
Mm.
I mean, we really liked it, and we thought this is so insane because everyone calls that the pilot, which it wasn't. It was just it was a 20-minute short film, but it was really extreme and weird, and we thought, oh, I haven't really seen this before, but I think people are going to go, oh, God, I remember this sort of feeling of being forced to watch these trippy programs when you were ill.
Yeah.
And then we thought, we'll do a screening and invite all people that we like look up to and blah, blah, blah. And we did a screening in cinema in town, and it went down really well. And then people said, oh, you should do a TV show. And we never thought of that. Really? That's so mental. Who's going to do this? And I said, no, you should. And then I remember I was working at Channel 4 then, but also handing out VHS tapes of this show. Because I thought, I would like to get this made, but I don't know how.
Mm.
And then Talkback, Peter Fincham used to run Talkback, who's amazing. They approached us, and then we went to the BBC. And they said, yeah, we want to do this 10-minute slot. I'm like, oh, okay, only 10 minutes. Yeah, yeah, but we give you 6. And I said, can you give us 10? And they said, all right, we'll give you 8. So that was, I thought, well, that was weird. So we got 8 instead of 6. You can't do that anymore. So then we worked out, we thought, okay, so the 10 minutes. So this is a TV show. It's not people trapped in a cinema. So we don't want them to turn over. So we sort of formatted it a bit more and thought about it more in terms of like, kind of a TV program. But the rule when we made it was, we are making a real program for schools. We got no money. And, you know, the rule is everything is up for education. It's not meant to be funny. It's, you know, and if sometimes, I remember we use a film camera, and in film you have to like thing where you check the gate, where you open it and check if there's like hair or dust in it. And I remember I'd go, sorry guys, that we can't use that as the hair in the gate. And we go, no, keep it in.
Yeah.
And or we'd opened it and it was slightly like the light got on and it was a bit ruined. And we go, no, that's good. So, yeah, it was good. But it was quite intense because we filmed in this basement in Talkback Productions in town. And there would be this blue sheet of card or paper as the wall, and you'd be facing that all the time. And there were 2 days at the end when we had to film all the pickups, all the extra shots that, you know, of like putting bottles down, pointing to bottles. And that was like hell. That was torture filming that, because it was 2 days of that.
It's a glamorous world of TV, though, isn't it?
Mm. It was very glamorous.
It says on your Wikipedia page that you wrote for South Park.
Yeah, I did. Well, I got asked to, because I'd known Matt Stone from South Park for a long time because I've been to LA, worked there a few times, and he's obviously a hero. And he said once to me years ago, "Hey, you know, sometimes we take you know someone we like, and we go away for like a 3-day retreat somewhere nice. We talk crap and it's fun, and you know, about South Park, or we talk not even about South Park." And I always used to think, "Please ask me." And then about 2 years later, I got an email saying, "Hey, man, you remember me saying?" And then I thought, "Oh my God.
Did you play it really cool?"
No, I didn't. I was like, "Fuck yes, yes, I want to come." And then we went away to somewhere really nice in California, as like really nice, for 3 days. And I rewatched every episode of South Park. And then I started saying, "Okay, so I have this idea." They go, no, don't do any work, just like it's chat. So it's, I think the reason was because they make the show in 6 days, any extra ideas they might have, which by the way, they never write down, might be useful. So that was fun. And then it was, I was there for only 4 episodes, I think, because my visa wasn't done in time. And you're sitting in the room. To be honest, like, it's all Trey Parker writes it all. And I don't know if you know how it works, but you're in a room from 10 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 hours. And he just wants 3 ideas for scenes. And then he goes, "You can go now." And then you come back the next day. And I remember someone that worked there a lot said, "Oh, by the way, watch this." And I go, "What's it?" "Okay, do you want to see what we did?" Because him and Matt stay on afterwards, another team. And you go over to the edit suite and he's written, voiced, and they've edited, they filmed it, they made it all. Like,
what?
Yeah.
Like the finished version.
Basically, yeah, of those 3 scenes. So it's basically
the whole thing.
Yeah, in a day. What the stuff, so you come up, he said, "Oh, I like those 3 ideas for scenes." Then he writes them. You never see a script. There's no one has a computer. No one writes anything down. And then somehow, the writers never know how this happened because none of them have ever seen the script. He gives it to the animators. They voice it, put music to it, and they're proper scene, like done, 3 scenes. They're done. And then that happens every day. So you're just facilitating his mind. But I mean, as an English guy, it's tricky because, you know, you're like, okay, this one's all about, you know, summer camp. And you're like, "I don't know what that is." Or minor league baseball. But it was... Yeah, it was amazing, yeah.
It sounds like sort of partly a dream job and also slightly terrifying.
Yeah, it was. Well. It was a terrifying dream job. It wasn't a nightmare job. It was brilliant. Yeah. And but it was, you know, I mean, half the time I was freaking out because Trey was doing Cartman's voice and then Matt is doing Butter's voice and I'm like in between them like, "Oh my God, I can't believe this. Please just do Cartman more."
In fact, if you could just speak like Cartman the whole
please,
time.
Please, the whole time. So... yeah, which is my favourite voice.
Wow, that just sounds, yeah. Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and wonder whether that actually happened or not?
I don't actually, but I'm going to tonight just for you.
Now I've put that suggestion in.
I will tonight.
It just sounds a bit surreal. Like a bit
It was surreal. Also, it was surreal because there was an episode we did and I got death threats, I think.
Oh.
Because it might be to do with, I think, it was like maybe it was Muhammad or something. And then we were in the room... where we were, which is a big glass room, and one of the producers banged on the window, like someone, like Trey, and he said, "You know, I can't now, what?" And they banged again, said, "We're in the middle of something," and then that person went away and came out and with a piece of paper in red ink just stuck it to the window, and it said, "The FBI are here."
Wow.
Yeah, that was fun.
Incredible. Do you have a preference in terms of like writing for an existing series or writing your own shows, or do you just like writing?
I wanted you to say, do you have a preference for meat or fish?
We can do that after.
Yeah, we'll do that after. The Patreon lot can get that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like doing my stuff, definitely.
Yeah.
It's so hard because when you write with, you know, I wrote with Jamie Dimitri on staff for a few episodes, and he's a genius, by the way. And as if everyone didn't know. And it's always hard when it's someone else's voice completely. Like, I think if we brought someone else to write series one of Look Around You on, however good they were, it just would be really hard for them because it's not the thing that me and Pete have a shared voice we've been doing for, you know, a year. Yeah. And that shared thing that our little codes...
Also, if you didn't grow up in the 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And same with Jamie's thing, it's the way he writes. It's not even in half of it isn't even English, you know. It's grammatically wrong all the time. It's kind of based on how his dad speaks, which his dad's fantastic and so funny and hilarious. And the things he says, you couldn't write them unless you live with that man. Similarly, you probably couldn't write the things that my dad says. My favourite thing my dad said once was, I never got this in, I don't know why. I heard that my dad was going to a funeral, and when I was around there, I said, how was the funeral, Dad? And he went, oh, lovely. I went, lovely? And my mum goes, Michael, you didn't even go to the funeral. And he said, yeah, but he doesn't know that. So, which is, that's my dad summed up. So you couldn't write that if you didn't know that. And that's just sometimes the case with, you know, writing on someone's show. It's, you're almost there, but you're not quite there. Or sometimes you're there, but, you know. I think that's with anything with someone as a writing team, you get great scripts back, but then you have to, like, make it your own bit more, you know.
You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. And what? You want me to ask Robert Popper a question? Okay. I mean, I suppose I could. My question to Robert is, how did you get into comedy writing in the first place?
I play guitar and always wanted to be a musician and got to do music with Pete doing Look Around You, which is fun. But used to play in this band, not famous, never did anything, but we just argue all the time. One day I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm leaving the band. Bit awkward because my guitar amp was really heavy. They sort of had to help me take that down to the car. But at the same time, Knowing Me, Knowing You was on the radio with Partridge. And I just thought, I'd always loved comedy and always sort of thought I could do that if I wanted to try, maybe. And I just thought, oh, I want to do this. So that was kind of the impetus. And then I started writing Steve Coogan via his agent letters. So I wrote to him saying, I really like to write for you. I really like to work, you know, work for you or whatever, write with you.
Mm.
And but I know, I wrote to Alan Partridge. So I know you're a busy man. So I'll write your reply for you and you can just send it back to me. So then I wrote a letter as if he's writing to see that I could do his voice, whether I could or not, I don't know. But I thought, well, he must get lots of these letters. Well, he probably doesn't get lots of those letters. But then I thought I'd put it in a gold envelope. So I would buy gold paper and then I'd bombard him with these. And still to this day, when I see him, he says, I found another one of your gold envelopes in the loft. And so I did that. And then I think either they got in touch, said, well, we're making a TV show. We're not looking for writers, but if you want, you can have a go at writing a script, imagining a TV version. So I did. I spent like a week or whatever, and I wrote, you know, what that program might be, like an interview thing. And I sent it to them, and then they phoned and said, we love your scripts. Somewhat I'm boasting. But anyway, I didn't know anyone in TV, so this is my only route. So they said, it was the best one we had. It was really funny, but we're not using it because we're not using other writers, but just want to say, you capture the voice properly. So that was like me thinking, oh, okay, I'm going to have a really try and do this now. So, and it's funny, when I bumped into Patrick Marber, who was his co-writer, who's now a brilliant playwright, I saw him about 2 years later in the street. And I went up to him and said, Patrick Marber. He went, yeah. I went, Robert Popper. He goes, oh, we thought you'd have curly hair. So, that's how I started.
See, another example of you just doing it, just having a go. Yeah. Brilliant.
Well, yeah. I mean, when I got my job at the comic strip, I didn't know anyone in TV. So, but my mum knew someone who knew someone who knew someone's son worked with Esther Ranson on That's Life, or whatever it's called, literally. So go and meet him. I go, I don't want to meet him. Go and meet him. So I met him, and he took me to see the news being recorded. I don't know why. And he just said, write to producers whose TV shows you like. And I didn't know what producer was. And that is what I did. But when I wrote to the comic strip, I wrote a fake CV, which looks completely normal until you read that when I was four, I was the sole survivor of an air crash in the forests of British Columbia. And then it goes, reared by wolves. I spent the next 8 years hunting, gathering, learning the ways of the wild. And you go, oh my God, what the fuck's this? Because it looks really boring, the rest of it. And then it's all my jobs. And then I have fake references from there's one from I worked for a company called Purine, which was like human water. But it was and then the owner of that company wrote, you know, gave me a reference, but it's from Pentonville Prison. But so I did that, and that's got me interviews at places. And I got one for Peter Richardson at the comic strip. And I always loved the comic strip, and I went there. And as soon as I opened the door, I thought, oh, I want to. It was the most shambolic place. And when you flush the loo, the water would come out, and it was all higgledy piggledy.
And I went in there and said, I'll come see Peter. And then I heard him go, bring me the Wolfman. And I went upstairs and he was there with some writers. They were smoking dope. And I was thinking, blimey, what is this? And and I just sat there and they said, oh, we really love your CV. And they were reading it. And, oh, thank you. And blah, blah, blah. And then I sort of pitched him with some jokes. And Peter's quite sort of genius and vague in terms. He goes, oh, well, that's great. Okay. And I went, well, what happens now? He said, well, I don't know, maybe come back tomorrow. Okay. So then I went back the next day and rang the bell, and then the producer there or whoever it was said, oh, obviously it was Naira Park, who's now produced Space and produced Shaun of the Dead and one of the brilliantest film producers in the country. She said, what are you doing here? And I just said, Peter said I stopped work here today as a runner. And I said, really? I said, yeah. I said, he didn't tell me that. I said, yeah. And they went up and he came down and he was all embarrassed. Oh, I said, yeah, you said come back to start today. And he went, oh, yeah, right. Well, yeah, you better start. And then I got a job. So I'm lying.
Did you get a job? I'm still not sure whether you did get a job.
Yeah, there. Yeah. I worked there for 2 years. I got a job.
Wow, what a start to a career.
I don't know. All I knew that everyone always told me it's impossible to get a job in television. You can't. So you have to be really pushy. So I thought, oh, God, all right, then, I'll have a go. And it worked.
And then you were involved with a few bits of classic 90s TV as well, weren't you? Writing for Zig and Zag on The Big Breakfast and doing bits on the 11 o'clock show. It was an exciting TV landscape around that time, wasn't it?
Because on the 11 o'clock show, I was producing a show for Granada, which was terrible. It was a comedy panel show, which I was told I had to come up with an idea for comedy, and I came up with one, and it was a terrible idea. And he said, congratulations, you've got a pilot. I had to make the pilot. I hated making it. He said, congratulations, you've got a series. I had to make the fucking series. So I hated it. It was really destroyed me making it. It wasn't funny, and I hated it all. And I didn't like it in any way. And we had a shit office. But also, once a week for about 5 weeks, I was a producer on this show, sneak out of the office, put a wig on, and get dressed and go off and do this thing where I was someone called Simon Michael Simon. That wasn't my name. Matt Lucas came up with that name. And I was a roving reporter. I mean, and I had a autograph book, and we'd find out, or the people there would find out where a politician was, I don't know who it was, Martin Bell or whoever it was. And I would go up to them outside Big Ben. You couldn't do this now. And before I would go up to them, I'd fill my mouth up with mushroom soup or something. And I would go up to them with this autograph book like that. And they, oh, you want me to do an autograph? I'd nod. And they'd sign it, and then I would vomit on the floor, and they'd be shocked. Oh, my parents are so ashamed. And I would say, I can't believe I've been thick everywhere. Please don't tell Mr. Lovimer, he'll be livid. That's what I would say. But beforehand, it would normally be, today I've been, you do afterwards, I've been sent to meet MP Martin Bell. I hope I'm not thick, right? And I would be sick. But we also, the best one we ever did, which wasn't aired, I don't know why, because it was, I mean, I feel like a little punk now doing this, but it was Gorbachev was going somewhere to London School of Economics or somewhere. And I went up to him, he signed a thing, and I vomited. I felt terrible, this great man. And then, I'll tell you where it was. It was a delegation for African leaders, I think, at somewhere like London School of Economics or somewhere. And it was a row of black Daimlers on red carpet. I mean, now I'd be shot. And I was sick. And then you do it, and then you run. And then as we're running, the cameraman said, I fell over. I didn't get it. I tripped. I didn't get it. I was what? So we found a way he was going late. We did him again. It was awful. And then afterwards, I said to camera, I can't believe I was just thick in front of the second most powerful man in the world in the 80s. And that was never used. So
had echoes of the start of World War One and Archduke Ferdinand, that story, doesn't it?
World War Three.
Could have gone horribly wrong, couldn't it?
Yeah, this would be a very different podcast if that had happened. Anyway, that's my stupidity. Yeah.
Well, it's very 90s, isn't it?
I wouldn't do that now.
Robert, I've got something here I'd quite like to try on you.
Uh-oh.
Go on.
I've invented a machine called a write typer, which predicts what type of a writer you are.
Okay.
And historically, it's had 100% accuracy. So I'm fairly keen to give it a go and see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
If you could, first of all, tell me your favoured writing implement.
A sword. Well, laptop.
Laptop, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, people have said that the right typer loosely resembles one of those origami paper fortune tellers, but that is that's just a coincidence, really, I think.
I see, right, yeah, I'm with you.
So I'm going to pick from these four categories now, and you have to... you have to pick from the four categories. Okay, so there's Draft Dodger, Haley's Vomit, Bovril Latrine, or Clockwork Porridge. Which one of those would you like?
What do they mean?
I mean, you just have to choose.
I have to choose. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to predict what kind of a writer
you are.
I'm
with you, right. What was the last one? Clockwork Porridge.
Clockwork Porridge, okay. Okay, Clockwork Porridge. Whatever happens, you always have to hit word count. Day in, day out. You think this is good, but it's a prison sentence. Does that feel like that has nailed you correctly?
No.
Oh.
But no, it's not bad. I thought it was very well written and funny.
Thanks very much.
It's not word count, it's adjective count. So
okay.
So if I've done 65 adjectives, yeah, and I need to have about 20 adverbs, then I can move on.
Okay. Well, it's fairly close. It's,
it is pretty close. You just need to have a subsection of that answer next time, because I think there'll be a lot of writers that also work on adjectives.
In a similar way. Yeah. Do you think I can say that it has, maybe its percentage accuracy is like 96.4 or something?
I think so. I think you could say that, yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for playing.
That was a great game. Can we play it again? Can we do it again?
Wasn't it? I came up with that this morning.
That was like late 90s TV, John. Just has an idea and we'll just do it live.
Equivalent.
If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. Not going through committees and producers and stuff. We'll just see if it works.
All you need is someone to throw water on you and tell you it's acid.
That's someone to be sick.
Yeah.
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 Robert, I think we're probably taking up enough of your time now, haven't we?
Really? That was fun. Probably. That was great. Probably that was really good. That was great fun.
You know what? I was doing my in-depth research by reading your Wikipedia page, and the last thing on there, which is an entire section, out of all the stuff you've done, is mentioned, but there's an entire section on Tangerine Game.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
that's amazing, that was, yeah.
Popper, who often makes prank phone calls, rang up London radio station LBC, claiming he had seen Gordon Brown throw a tangerine into a laminating machine during a fit of rage.
Yeah. I was in my old flat and I phoned. It was all about the time when, like, I said, Gordon Brown has got a bad temper. Mm. You know, it's anger. And I thought, oh, this would be good. I'm subsequently banned from LBC, by the way. My phone is barred. My wife's barred. And when we had a home phone, that was barred. Genuinely.
Brilliant.
Because I phoned them a lot. But I thought, I'm going to make something up. And so you get through to, like, the researcher, first of all. And I was in my kitchen and there was one tangerine in a bowl. I thought, okay. So I said, I work with him. I do like the Robin Cooper voice, but not as crazy to them. I work with him. I was at work and work at laminating a factory, and Jordan Brown came to tour it and he was terribly angry. Oh, they're like, really? He was so rude. Oh, really? They're like, this sounds good. And he was having lunch. He had a phone call and he threw a tangerine into it, and it broke the whole machine. We had to stop production. It was awful. All right, well, hold the line then. And then, you know, 10 minutes later, I'm on. And when I didn't, and I thought, what did I say? He said, and he called, he was really angry on the phone, and he threw the thing and it jammed the machines, and he blamed, like, his aide or something and called her a citric idiot. And then, anyway, I did that. I thought, well, that's funny. And I, like, edited it and whatever, and I might put it on Twitter then or not. But 2 days later, someone texted me an article from, I think it was the Financial Times, and then it was like in loads of papers that this thing happens. So, and then people started calling it Tangerine Gate. I couldn't believe it. I was reading, you know, like it was in like The Sun, it was in lots of papers.
Mm.
And I thought I'd get a knock on the door.
Wow.
From the British Tangerine Association.
That deserves its own little bit on Wikipedia, actually, in retrospect.
It does, actually, yeah.
Fair enough. Mm. Fair enough.
It was an important bit of history.
It was, yeah, very important bit of social history, British social. They'll be teaching that, you know.
It's a shame that when you said he threw the tangerine into the laminating machine that it jammed, when in fact it would have marmaladed. Really.
I should have said that.
See, on that bombshell.
On that bombshell.
Robert, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. That was really great.
It's been lovely chatting with you. Thank you, Robert.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
That interview is a lesson in not overthinking it and just going ahead and doing it.
Yeah, have an idea, do idea.
Good way to go, didn't it?
Hey, guys, guess what I've got here?
What?
I've got my write typer that can predict the type of writer you are.
You say that. I like the way with Robert Popper, initially you went no, but then you kind of did the thing that like mediums and psychics do, and where you kind of like... Got into it. It's kind of true, isn't it? And he came out the other end believing that it was true. You did quite a good sort of cold reading on him.
Well, that's
very impressive.
That's because it is true.
No, I'm
Tom.
Sure it is. Well, let's try it out.
Yeah.
So, Birdie, what kind of implement do you prefer to write with?
A keyboard?
Keyboard, okay. Okay.
I can hear exactly what that is.
Brilliant sound effects. You need to choose 1, 4, 5, or 8.
8.
Okay. Birdie, you are a Pumpelstiltskin.
Am I?
Yes.
What is that, John? What's a Pumpelstiltskin?
Well, I'll read it to you.
All right.
You only have to fart and a great idea magically appears. Unfortunately, no one else recognizes your amazing ideas for what they are, and so they fall through the floor, never to appear again. Is that true?
That is. Do you know what? That is. I go along with that.
I would go along with that. Another one.
Because I am. I do have good ideas, and I am quite flatulent. So that it all ties in.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Tom, do you want to have a go?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah.
Give me what you like to. What do you like to write with?
Computer. Is that all?
Okay. You have to choose between 1, 2, 3, or 6.
1.
1. You are a draft dodger.
Oh.
You hate redrafting and editing, so you tinker as you write, and therefore end up editing way more because of it.
We don't know if that's true yet, do we? So I've never really finished
that's
anything.
That's true, yeah.
Should we call it true then?
It sounds quite true.
Yes, we'll call it true.
We'll call it true for now.
Yeah, no, it's amazing that, John.
Isn't that incredible?
Really is amazing. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
That's 4 out of 4, 100%.
Wow.
Weird, isn't it? Weird. It's such a simple machine as well, but it does know what it's doing.
Somehow it always works. Can I just hold this under your chin?
Oh, no, yeah, go for it.
I reckon you like butter. Do you like butter?
I think, should we move on
yeah,
now?
Yeah, I mean, have you got an appointment at Dragon's Den or anything you need to get to? Or no, are we all right for time?
Not yet. Not yet, Tom.
Right.
Yeah, it's probably time now to have a look at something that our listener has been working on.
Our one listener.
Yeah.
Our listeners have been working on. What have we got today, Thomas?
We have got something called Hotbox by Aaron Court.
Before you say anything else, Tom, can I just give a little shout out to Aaron and his daughters, Emery and Isabella, because they are both burgeoning writers in their own rights as well. And I'm saying this because they often listen in the car together.
We're inspiring the next generation.
That's it. Yeah. Exactly. The next generation of listener and of writer. So hi, folks. If you are all in the car together, that's me waving, by the way. Continue, Tom. Sorry.
Yes. So, Aaron has sent us an excerpt from his forthcoming book titled Hotbox. He sent us a little snippet of it. Should we do that first? And then we can...
That's a good idea. Otherwise, we won't know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Before we do that, Aaron sent us an email and he explained, in this extract, it's March 2003 and Corporal Danner has returned from a 4-day ammo run in Kuwait as the Marines prepare to invade Iraq.
Sorry, I think that's Iraq, John.
Yeah. Sorry. My mistake. And he says, how should I say what's going on? He's stressed out. So let's have a listen.
Excerpt from Hotbox by J. Aaron Courts. Corporal Danner stared at the bunker somewhat dazed, the one he called Hotbox, and his mind settled on a feeling which he couldn't shake. He waited mere feet from the bunker while the entry control point guards obtained authorization for his re-entry into camp. It had been a couple of weeks since his driver and him and dozens of others were nearly crushed in the bunker, and Corporal Danner wondered if the Marine who had panicked, the one haunting him, was stateside yet. The Marine had ripped his gas mask off and tried to shoot himself in the head. If he'd carried a pistol like Corporal Danner, he would have succeeded, but he couldn't chamber around, get his finger on the trigger, and keep the barrel of his rifle in his mouth, squeezed in the bunker as they all were. Corporal Danner saw his teeth shatter when someone yanked the barrel out of his mouth. Without his firearm, he was left with only one option, and after a few moments, he drew his K-bar and fought several of his brothers violently to try and shove it through his eye and into his brain. They stopped him again, but lost all composure in the melee, and he was beaten into the sand mercilessly. They left him broken and bleeding until the all clear was sounded. Then Corporal Dana did as everyone else and stepped over his body, simply relieved that the Marine was quiet and still. One of the guards on post made room for Corporal Dana in the cami netting's broken shade, but he stood motionless in the sun and tried to let his guilt seep, just as they had let the Marine's blood seep, into the sand to disappear. "Turned your scab in?" the guard asked, but what he meant was, "Are you cold? Do you have a fever?" He moved over and created even more space for Corporal Dana to join him out of the sun. He ignored the question at first, then looked at the guards more closely. They had fresh, suede boots, absent the inevitable sand-burnished tips, and only the faintest hint of salt rings formed on their blouses at the base of their flak jackets and around their armpits. And this guard, the one without a radio, was asking about the scabs. "They're fresh," he thought. Then memories of his own arrival flooded his mind and replaced those of the bunker he swore never to set foot in again. Almost everyone received a smallpox vaccination before they arrived in country. In fact, Corporal Dana didn't know of anyone who hadn't. Some of the older Marines carried the pocked thumbprint-sized scar on their shoulder, of course, but for the vast majority, they were vaccinated in the hours prior to boarding their war-bound planes and had about a week in country before their swollen glands and fever ground them into their racks. "This is going to turn into a sore, then scab over," the corpsman told Corporal Dana as he prepared the bifurcated needle. "You'll feel a little sick in a few days. Probably have a slight fever." He pricked Corporal Dana's shoulder a few times, then continued, "Don't touch it, and don't pick at the scab. It's a live virus. Here, take this." Each Marine and sailor was given a small Ziploc bag with an individually wrapped alcohol swab and one Band-Aid. "Now," the corpsman continued, "when the scab falls off..." He looked into Corporal Dana's eyes for the second time since asking him to confirm his name and social security number. "Do not pick the scab." Corporal Dana held the clear bag up and studied it. "When it falls off," he said again, "collect it in the bag, then wipe your hands with the alcohol swab and put the Band-Aid over the wound." "What do I do with the baggie?" Corporal Dana asked. "Keep it on you." "No, after I collect the scab. What then? Throw it away?" The corpsman looked at him for the third time. "No, Corporal, do not throw a live virus in the trash for others to handle. Give it to your corpsman in country."
"Roger."
"Don't pick the..." "Yeah, I got it, Doc. Don't pick it, don't eat it, don't throw it away. Copy all."
The corpsman sighed and looked down at the roster.
"Next!"
Took about a week for it to happen, but he did get sick. Everyone did. In fact, when the fever hit, he was useless for days. He laid on his cot and moved only enough to drag himself to a port-a-john or the closest bunker when alarm sounded. The glands in his neck, armpits and groin were swollen, and he'd sweated through the cot so thoroughly one night he thought he'd pissed himself. He woke up starving on the third day and seriously considered if they'd mixed up the smallpox with a dose of something more bubonic. Corporal Dana stared up at the Bedouin tent which sprawled over dozens of Marines to protect them from the sun and wind. His eyes were drawn to the strange mustard-coloured cloth and could see in his peripheral a line of red cotton tassels stretched like gypsy crown moulding along the seam where the side walls and draped ceiling panels met. An itch pulled his mind away from the warm colours. Nothing intolerable, exactly. It was something more soothing, like an itch being scratched, maybe. He hadn't experienced anything soothing since his arrival in country, and the oddity of the sensation shoved itself past the tense tassels and mesmerizing colors, the ravenous hunger which follows a three-day stupor and every other delirium his mind conjured. An uncanny realization stood alone in the forefront. Something was scratching him, scratching an itch on his arm. He turned his head, and his eyes widened. He was frozen stiff, and yet his own hand was there, self-animate and lightly scratching his shoulder.
Fuck!
Corporal Danner jumped out of the rack and held his right hand as far from his body as he could while he fumbled through a small pile of gear to find his blouse. A tan button popped off his chest pocket and skidded across the plywood deck as he stepped on the bottom of the blouse and tried to free the Ziploc bag from the pocket under his name tag. Corporal Danner wiped his contaminated right hand until the alcohol swab had dried and was thankful it wasn't his left. His wedding band wouldn't have come off if it had been, and the thought of smallpox incubating under his ring made him shudder. Then he opened the band-aid and placed it over the red, slime-filled hole in his arm. Dried flesh rimmed the wound, and a small pool of blood where the scab was unanchored leaked through the cheap plastic bandage. Maybe it stuck to the cut. Corporal Danner pulled back the camouflage poncho liner that had been his blanket during fever fits to look for the scab. He held the poncho liner by its binding, like his touch would pop an invisible spider's egg sac and thousands of frenzied arachnids would crawl up his arms and neck and lose themselves in his hair. There was no scab. He looked on the deck, under and around his cot. No scab. The fucking poncho liner! He held the liner up and turned it in the fluorescent light of a fixture attached to the nearest tent pole. He examined one side and then the other. No scab. It might as well have sprouted legs and scurried away like one of the tiny spiders. What the actual fuck? It was lost. He stood there for a few moments and collected his thoughts. Well, shit, he said, then went to the trash can under the same light fixture and threw his Ziploc bag away with the used swab and wrappers sealed inside.
Hey! A voice said. You're supposed to give that to the corpsman! You can't throw that!
Scab's gone, Corporal Danner said. A torso shot up three cuts down.
What do you mean it's gone? Where'd it go?
Not sure.
What do you mean you're not sure? It's gotta be...
Must have eaten it in my sleep, Corporal Danner said. The other Marine's mouth dropped, and he had to catch himself before he fell from his rack. Bitch made mother fuck. Corporal Danner reached for his blouse and cover and smiled at the gaping Marine, then walked outside and headed to the mess tent. In the coming days, more people woke up terrified of their missing scabs than of overhead fire, and fewer bags were turned into medical. Before long, rolled-up band-aids littered the camp in greater number than cigarette butts at a bus stop, and the sergeant major had troops in latex gloves and their gas masks police the entire camp in a single-file line to collect the little disease-filled roll-ups.
Is it that bad?
The guard asked again and snapped Corporal Danner's attention to the ECP.
The smallpox, I mean.
He stood silent and waited for whatever Corporal Danner would say.
I got mine a few days ago, and everybody keeps telling me it's gonna suck, but I don't feel...
Oh, yeah. These guys are fresh.
Just got here?
Corporal Danner asked.
3 days ago, Corporal,
the guard said.
Him too.
And he pointed to the other guard who stood beside a small field desk and held the radio's handset to the side of his head.
And they already have you on post? Today's my first day,
the guard said.
Everyone I arrived with was told to report to the camp commandant, some female lieutenant, and then some Chinese staff sergeant put us on the duty roster. Couldn't understand a word he said. Something about a...
Korean.
What?
The guard asked.
That staff sergeant Howe. He's Korean, not Chinese.
Oh yeah, I saw his name on the board. Hio.
The guard chuckled.
Same shit, right?
It's pronounced Howe. And ask staff sergeant Hio if he's Chinese,
Corporal Danner said.
See what he thinks about the difference.
Now, Aaron did say in his email, he did say there's really a lot more humour in the entire thing than this section presents.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of an easy way out, isn't it, that really?
It is, oh, a bit, yeah, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, the bit I've sent you isn't that funny, but the rest of it is really funny. There's, yeah, a lot of humour in it. But no, yeah, just to give people an idea. What do we think, boys?
I think the first thing that's really obvious about it is that this is clearly written by somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, you know, the setting and the sort of language and the mechanics of it all, it's clear that this is rather, as opposed to the stuff that we do, this is someone who knows what they're talking about, and it sounds right. And it has a really nice sort of flow to it as well. Mm. So I thought it was quite easy to read.
It gets you straight in there as well, doesn't it? Because you immediately, yeah, understand that they know exactly what they're talking about in terms of the scenario and the world that they've plonked you into.
Yeah.
So you feel very safe in the writing in that you kind of, there's no tricks being pulled. You're like in it.
You're in good hands.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was going to ask you two a question.
Mm.
I read it in a particular genre, and I wondered if you heard it the same way.
Go on.
Well, when I was reading it first, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be a horror story.
Oh, interesting.
Rather than like a straight military sort of thing, this is going to be like a horror tale.
That's interesting. And what was it that sent you down there?
I don't know. It was something about the scabs and the insistence that no one should touch.
Right, yeah,
anything.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Do you know, and I was thinking, oh, is this going to have some element of like there's some sort of experiment going on where they've all been infected with a, you know, some sort of alien parasite,
some kind of pathogen that turns them into fearless warriors or something. Or kind
that's
of like...
probably completely wrong, but that's how I sort of initially, like knowing nothing else about it, that was my sort of initial take.
Isn't it interesting?
Do you know, it never even occurred to me to think outside the hot box.
No. No, outside I was the box same. On that. Yeah.
What I did think was really, really good about it, actually, and it takes a bit of writing talent to do this, is using the scab and the injection as a vehicle to tell this little bit of story, where that's the main... You know, when you've got those stories or writers in charge of the story where they can focus you in on such a tiny thing, but then the rest of this world revolves all around it and you get to see little snippets and different people coming in and characters.
Yeah.
I thought that was done really, really well in this. Like, really well.
Yeah, and the kind of madness, in a way, that just those scabs, it sort of takes its toll on the whole squadron, doesn't it? It's like, you know, there's this tiny little thing and it kind of spirals out of control. Do you know what it reminded me of? One of my favourite books of all time, in fact, is Catch 22.
Oh, right.
But it reminded me of that a little bit, in the sense that he'd captured the sense of a kind of insane situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Of,
of
a group of people who could die at any minute, you know, and everybody just has to kind of get on with it. But you end up with a sort of absurdist kind of humour, but it's also quite moving, you know. It's the way that we behave in certain extreme situations isn't always the best, and the kind of futility of the violence as well. I just thought it did remind me of that.
But I think any sort of war book like this, story like this, has that ability, doesn't it? Because it becomes in its very own completely sealed bubble of life. There isn't a shop down the road, there isn't the rest of the world going on. You're in this weird camp. And that's it. That's your world. That's the rules. That's the whole thing. And it does, you're right, it does lend you to this kind of...
It's like collective madness.
Yeah, it kind of hyper-focuses you in, doesn't it?
But even within that self-contained world, you have your other sort of layers of separation as well. Obviously, you've got your different ranks and that, but then you've got the sort of newbies coming in and the people who have already experienced the scam. Mm.
Yeah, yeah, kind of the hardened...
the guys who have, he's only done it 3 days ago, he knows what's coming. Do you know what I mean? So they're all within their little groups, even within that sort of concentrated group.
Little pretentiousness alert. But I thought the scab was maybe like a metaphor for the bit of yourself that you fear. And if that is what Aaron was going for, I thought that was really nice, because it seemed to apply quite well, if you know what I mean. Everybody's slightly afraid of this little bit of themselves, if you know what I mean. It's clever. Right. It's a clever bit of writing.
And how they're told they mustn't touch it and they mustn't...
Don't scratch it,
scratch it, and they must... Yeah, that you've got to leave that little bit alone.
It's interesting, isn't it? That, like, even with two people reading the same thing... You can go for it being a metaphor, and I think it's some sort of alien...
Zombies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You can tell a lot about someone by how they interpret a book, perhaps.
But yes, it was good. Yeah, in terms of Aaron's writing, I think you kind of mentioned this before, but it's simple, isn't it? It's not overblown. And he's not signposting everything.
Well,
you
don't notice.
He's just
it.
Getting on with the job of
no,
telling
exactly.
the story.
I think that's a sign of like good writing, is you don't really notice the writing.
Yeah, the story floats across the top.
Like
of
you're
it.
Not having the metaphor or the theme like rammed down your throat. It's just you're just being told this tale, and you get from it whatever you get from it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think his easy dialogue as well helps with that, doesn't
it? Yeah, lots of dialogue.
But it's very not trying to be too clever or weave too much stuff in.
Yeah.
It just keeps moving you along and showing you a little bit about the characters.
And an insight into a really fascinating world, which is always always good in books, I think.
Well, the boy done good, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Very good. Very good, mate.
I took this as an opportunity to say to Aaron, Semper Fidelis, which I had to look up to see what it meant, having not done Latin.
I don't think you're allowed to say it, Dave, not having been an ex-Marine. I think now they have to hunt you down now. I think.
Yeah, no, I looked up. I did look up whether it was acceptable to say that to a Marine. And apparently it is, as long as you do it in a respectful way. Which I hope I've just done.
Okay, you just saved yourself a beating there, mate.
I've just there. Just.
It was close, but I think you're all right.
It was, wasn't it?
I've got the door
Can't
locked.
Say I'm not a little bit disappointed, but well done, Dave.
Yeah.
No, so that's brilliant. If anyone's interested in finding any more bits from Aaron, there will be a few links to his Substack articles and a few other bits in the show notes. So if you want to find out more,
have a look at that.
That's where you'll find him. Thank you very much, Aaron. Much appreciated.
And also, we should say, if you want to send us a bit of your writing, we would love to read it. And if we like it, we might turn it into a nice bit of audio production like that and have a little natter about it. So, send us whatever it is, story, novel, extract, poem, whatever.
Bit of flash fiction.
Send it over. Yeah. Don't be shy. failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com.
In a couple of weeks' time, we've got the next episode, and homework for people is to involve yourself in the world of Scarfolk, which is a very strange place.
It is. If you've never visited...
Is it Scarfolk or Scarfolk?
I don't know. I was going to ask exactly that.
Yeah.
I think he said Scarfolk, didn't he, at one point?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
It sounds a bit wrong if you say Scarfolk.
but yeah, it's a very, very strange place. I think that's all. I'm not even going to try and explain it.
No, but I guarantee you'll enjoy your visit there.
Especially anyone that's lived through the sort of the 70s and 80s in the UK.
Yeah, especially.
There'll be some weird bells ringing and I'll be a bit weird. But yeah, have a look at that. And we are going to talk to the creator of Scarfolk, Richard Littler. Yeah.
Well, I look forward to that.
Yeah. And until then, let's all go away and get some more bloody words written.
Yes,
Dave.
Yes, I will write something.
Right, thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for putting up with us. And if you like the show, remember to do all the things, subscribe. And
just go and
share
tell people. Tell people.
Your besties.
Yeah.
Shout it from
Don't
from
just
the
keep us as your dirty little secret.
Do you think that's what it is? You think people are just embarrassed to share it? Embarrassed to admit they like
this. It's possible.
To say they like it, what you could do is go, oh, I'll tell you what, have you heard about the Failing Writers Podcast? Ugh, I don't listen to it, but I've heard some people do, and there's some funny bits.
You should listen to it.
Have a listen, see what you think, because I listened, I didn't like it. It seemed weird, but have a listen to 20 or 30 episodes and see what you think. God, that's we're happy with that. That's all right as well.
Do you think we've become like a bit of a guilty pleasure? Is that what we've become?
Yeah, probably.
A secret underground.
Do you know what? I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
I don't mind that at all.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, if you do that, if you build it up for a bit longer, you've got a chance of becoming some kind of cult or something then, haven't you?
Is that what we're going for?
That can be quite profitable.
You can get a lot of money out of that.
I don't see why not.
Don't you need more charismatic leaders for that kind of thing?
I think a lot of it's drugs as well, isn't it? So there's like a mix. So I don't think we have to... Yeah,
no, you're right.
We don't have to let that stop us, per se.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. On that note, goodbye, everybody.
Yes, goodbye, everyone.
Don't take drugs, by the way. Don't take drugs.
Yeah, well, you say that, John, but were you on drugs when you did this little remix?
Do we have Scar in the house? No matter what the age of crime, we're
Yes.
But you
I'll call back later on.
Nothing to do with the TV, though.
Oh, don't worry, man. And we keep cats here.
No matter what the age of crime,
right.
It smells quite nasty.
Do we have Scar in the house?
I'll call back later on for you, all right?
Good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good night.
Where's everybody gone?